It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simorgh Award. This time too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. The situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in five categories, including Best Direction, Best Visual Effects, and Best Sound Mixing, as well as the Golden Simorgh Award for the top film of the festival. Directed by Hadi Hejazi Farr, the war drama documents two major operations Iran carried out during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Laureates believe the cinematic event has played a major role in upgrading the Iranian cinema industry.
I'm so happy to be acknowledged in my first presence as a director in the festival. I should thank all of those who supported me. The festival encourages the filmmakers to try to excel, and this is what makes the entire film industry grow.
Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the cinematic event kicked off on February the 1st and screened feature and short films as well as documentaries over the course of 10 days.
The 40th Fajr Film Festival rolled back the red carpet with smiles and tears. For sure, it was a memorable night for those who nabbed the Crystal Simorgh, as their films will definitely go down in the list of the blockbusters of Iranian flicks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Painting pictures of a revolution that shook the world to its core more than four decades ago. Children born here, but staying connected to Iran.
I think the Islamic Revolution has brought a lot of joy to many people, and basically it shows that we are Muslims and we are proud of who we are.
The paintings are part of a ceremony at the Islamic Center of England, in the heart of London, on the 43rd anniversary of a day that changed the course of Iranian history.
Before Islamic Revolution in Iran, there was not such a good relationship, from the Pahlavi regime with a religion, and because it was based on a secular system.
Led from exile in France by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled a U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic Republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. To the Shah's Western backers, the perceived loss of a modernized Iran under his rule to an Islamic Republic was a consequential blow to their interests in the region. What followed was four difficult decades that saw a devastating Western-backed war in the 1980s, an ongoing economic war, military threats, and relentless demonization.
The West hates Iran. They surround it with military bases. They supplied bombs and ammunition and poison gas. The extraordinary thing, though, is that Iran is probably at a point where instead of being on the defensive, it may be able to go forward and give a lead to a world badly in need of a new lead.
To other non-Iranians, the revolution has qualities that makes it relevant to the world today.
For me, as a Muslim in the 21st century, it's important to try to find leadership that instills the concept of taqwa, that instills the concept of piety and talks about the concept of unity.
For more than four decades now, Iran has defied many who had predicted the revolution's imminent collapse. At 43, these participants tell us it's a stable country in an unstable region, powerful militarily, and as united as ever against hegemonic powers. Saeed Horizat, London.
France has totally rejected a legal request for the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner, Georges Ibrahim Abdallah, who is known as the Arab Nelson Mandela. In 1982, Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the deaths of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris, saying they were the legitimate acts of self-defense of a country under foreign invasion. Abdullah's trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to secretly working for the government. Ultimately, it seems that France has inaccurately classified Abdallah not as a soldier, but as a common criminal. There have been favorable court decisions for Abdallah over the decades, but governmental interference has not allowed them to be implemented or respected. If France refuses to let their courts release Abdallah, then it seems they are intent on forcing him to die in jail, and in a country which prides itself on having abolished the death penalty a few decades ago. Abdallah refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and many believe that's a primary reason why he hasn't been released.
George is a fighter. He'll have no problem with this latest injustice. After 37 years of harassment, bullying, and humiliation, he is well aware that the deck is stacked against him. George maintains a vast global correspondence despite his imprisonment, and he still lives for the movement of anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics.
The fight for the liberation of George Abdallah has gone from total obscurity to becoming an international cause, with anti-French protests recently held in North Africa, Lebanon, and even Latin America. Demonstrators say that they and Abdallah's supporters worldwide will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gehli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution. As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran
and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old, as old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
In a statement at the end of the events, the demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country.
Analysts believe that after 43 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic Revolution, Iran has currently been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking and the oppressed nations of the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tafai. Demonstrators in Kabul have condemned President Joe Biden's order freeing up around $3.1 billion in Afghan assets held in the U.S. for families of America's 9/11 victims, saying that the money belongs to Afghans. Some of this money has been termed, in terms of the U.S. keeping it, as a form of theft. Others are saying that this money should be given to Afghans. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the justification or lack of it from the U.S. on allocating this money to victims of 9/11, and not Afghans who are facing a humanitarian, not to mention an economic crisis of epic proportions in their country. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Jim Kavanaugh joining us. He's a writer and blogger at The Polemicist from New York. Also joining us, Brian Terrell, political commentator, and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. You know, this has been blasted all over the place, especially in social media, about the U.S. decision or the decision by Joe Biden to do this. What is your take on the way that the U.S. went about, the thinking that it went about to make this decision? Because obviously we're looking at the situation in Afghanistan and what the Afghans are dealing with.
Well, it's... It is theft, and it's unspeakably cruel at a time like this, at a time this winter. And it's what's been happening these more than 20 years. Rather than sanctions, the United States ought to be paying reparations if there's any justice. Usually a country that carries on a war of aggression and loses, it has to pay up. And the U.S. should have no say about how that money is to be used. The average age, the median age in Afghanistan now is a few months over 18 years. So more than half the people in Afghanistan were not alive on 9/11. They do not owe any debt to the people who died on that horrible occasion here in the United States on 9/11, 2001. And most Afghans didn't know about the events of 9/11 until the bombs started dropping and the U.S. soldiers occupied. The U.S. supposedly already spent more money on the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and this is from the government's own inspector general, than the entire Marshall Plan that rebuilt Western Europe after World War II. And I visited Afghanistan. I was there, I think, seven times between 2010 and 2019. And over those years, while there's billions of dollars were being spent on reconstruction, going to U.S. Contractors, going to Afghan oligarchs, I just saw the city, the infrastructure of the city, just decay. With every visit, the city of Kabul was more insecure, was dirtier, was
that's interesting.
Yeah, and so it's 300 million dollars a day spent on the war, not on the reconstruction, but on the war going in Afghanistan,
right.
and these people, the people in Afghanistan, so, are victims.
You know, that's a good point that I didn't think of, which I will address to you, Jim Cavanaugh, if I can. So our guest there, Brian Terrell, talks about how he has visited Afghanistan. All the money did not show itself on the ground where it should. I'm guessing from schools to hospitals to basic infrastructure, perhaps. And then now you have this incident happen in which you have the U.S. taking half of that money, which amounts to about $3.1 billion, where you have no money circulating in the country. Millions are on the brink of starvation. How did Joe Biden think that this is going to help Afghanistan and to solve its crisis?
Well, he doesn't care whether it's going to help Afghanistan solve its crisis. This is a political stunt for the American political theater. And, you know, it plays well. We're taking care of the families of the 9/11 victims. Look, I lived a half a mile from the Twin Towers on 9/11. You know, I'm all for helping the 9/11 families. The United States doesn't have to take money from Afghanistan to do that. No Afghans were involved in 9/11, even according to the official story. The plot was hatched in Hamburg, Germany. So you know, to make the Afghans pay for this now after 20 years of war, in which at least 45,000, 46,000, probably 50,000 more Afghan civilians were killed. You know, this is kind of a gratuitous joke to say the Afghans owe us money for 9/11. And it is a kind of gratuitous cruelty. As Brian said, you know, the money that was poured into Afghanistan didn't help real social development of the Afghan people. It went to the oligarchs and the contractors and the weapons manufacturers. And what's happened, and, you know, there was a crisis, an economic and social crisis in Afghanistan before the United States pulled out. So now they're going to make the Afghan people pay essentially this ridiculous, as Brian said, idea that the Americans go in and make war in a country for 20 years, kill 50,000 civilians, and then say, oh, you got to pay us for that. This is ridiculous. You know, it's kind of absurd. You know, when the United States defeated Nazi Germany, they didn't say, Germans, you have to, they tried that in Versailles, didn't work very well, you have to pay us. They poured money into the country. And so, you know, they had, not only are they taking this money, but they're imposing sanctions on the government. They just want to punish the Taliban for defeating them. And Biden wants to make political capital in the United States with, look what I'm doing. I'm taking this money from the, you know, the dirty Taliban to give to good American families who suffered from 9/11. And it's really, that's unfortunately, it's going to work well in the American theater, I think.
Well, let me ask you, if I can, I don't know if you can answer this, Brian Terrell, but talk about this decision to give the money, half of it, to the 9/11 victims, and whether it's justified or not. One source, and I'm not too sure, I can't say it's authentic or not, but I'm wondering if you have an idea, said that 9/11 families have been supported financially for 20 years by states, nonprofits, and for this move, it's not right to take away from the mouths of starving Afghans and to give these 9/11 families more money. Again, as our guest there said, there's nothing wrong with giving 9/11 family members money. So I'm wondering if this was indeed something that happened where they were taken care of by states and nonprofits, and whether the decision, did it run for a second in the U.S. mind that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia and we should go be asking money from them?
Yeah, I do know some people who were victims of 9/11 who don't feel like they've been compensated enough, and I don't know if they could be. But it's not clear whether this money, just as the half of the money that's going to be supposedly going to help the Afghans, whether it's going to get there or not. And also, it's questionable whether this money that's been allocated for the families of the 9/11 victims, whether they're going to get it. And I think about all this money that's been spent. If the United States truly had rebuilt the infrastructure of Afghanistan, if they had actually built the hospitals that the people of the United States were billed for, that never existed, where the ground was never broken, if they had built the schools that they said that they built, and that so many Americans feel so proud of ourselves for building, if they had done that, Afghanistan would be a very secure place now, and the region would be much more secure. So this is all, you know, we're really making the world much more dangerous. And I'm glad people are out on the street in Kabul. And I'm tomorrow in many American cities, there's going to be people at American peace movement. People are going to be at federal buildings and other government facilities demanding that this. Decision be reversed. Sure. And people will be calling the White House, and I really hope that we will rise to that occasion and make these demands.
Well, talk about Afghans. Jim Kavanaugh, one of the Afghans out on the streets, said this, and I'm quoting him. Of course, it's been translated. I don't think the U.S. has the right to use Afghanistan's money to compensate 9/11 victims. The U.S. had no reason when it attacked us, but a lot of people died in the past 20 years. So it's the U.S. that should compensate us, and they should not spend our money. Does he have a point?
Oh, yes. Look, even Karzai, the American installed president of Afghanistan, said this was an atrocity. You know, again, it's at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed for something the Afghans didn't do. And so they've, you know, paid dearly for whatever imaginary crimes the United States wanted to, you know, blame on them rather than the Saudis or the German government, which, you know, harbored Mohammed Atta. So, you know, the idea that now what we have to do is impose sanctions and take away the assets, the currency, the gold of the Afghan government to compensate ourselves for what we've done to the people of Afghanistan, it's certainly, you know, if you could find a better way for the United States to guarantee that Afghanistan is not going to be friendly to it, and guess where it's going to turn? It's not going to turn to the United States. It's going to turn to China for help and assistance, and then they'll be whining about that. So it's a very silly notion in terms of even the geopolitical intelligence of the United States, but it's also, as I say, gratuitously cruel, and it's done for Joe Biden to score political points, which he will score, and, you know, because the Republicans and his opponents would attack him if they gave the money to the Afghan government Afghan people who deserve to have it.
That's unfortunate to look at it that way, but yeah. Well, Brian Terrell, you said that a lot of the population in Afghanistan is, I think, 18 years old. I'm not too sure what percentage you used.
It's the median age is 18.
18. Okay.
I'm going to build on that. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to build on that and come at you using that stat, along with how overall you're looking at about, based on what we have, 24 million people who are suffering from acute hunger. That's 60% of the population. Not to mention the drought. Not to mention the fact that there's been recently a measles outbreak. So obviously the humanitarian aspect and the economic situation along with this is very dire. Add to that the 18-year-old average age, it sounds like this is perfect breeding ground for terrorists to exploit, which is what we have present currently in Afghanistan in terms of Al-Qaeda presence there with Khorasan. So has the U.S. thought how this can turn out to be a national security threat, maybe towards the U.S., since the U.S. president has decided to withhold this money and give it to 9/11 victims?
Well, I don't think it's in the interest of the arms manufacturers that there be, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Technologies, that peace is not going to break out anytime soon, as he assured his the investors when Biden pretended he was going to stop arming the Saudis. So they don't want peace to break out. General McChrystal, when he was the head of U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan under President Obama, was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine, and he said that with every innocent Afghan who's killed, we create 10 new enemies. So we see that metric on July 29th of this last year, the Ahmadi family who were killed by a drone strike, 10 people killed, 100 new enemies by General McChrystal's count were created that day. And if
100
you're
what? I'm sorry.
100 new enemies.
Right.
For everyone you kill, any innocent person, the United States creates 10 new enemies for itself. So that's good news if your investments are in Raytheon and in Boeing and in these other arms manufacturers. This is what President Eisenhower warned about in the military-industrial complex back in 1960, the fear that the United States is going to be not making weapons so it can fight wars, but making wars so it can sell weapons. I think we've really come to that, and it's just a harsh reality that a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan that had fair and honest dealings with its neighbors, and its neighbors include Iran and include China and Pakistan. Peace breaking out in Afghanistan would be bad news for the U.S. economy. And so it's when things are so predictable, as you put it, that this is going to be a more breeding ground for more terror. Of course,
that's what happened in Iraq.
Yeah. It, of course, it will be. And if something is that clear, so much to be inevitable, you have to suspect then that it's intentional. And on one level, this really is intentional.
You agree with
this
that?
Gratuitous
then.
Cruelty is is there's a purpose behind it.
Sure. Okay. Well, Jim Kavanaugh, do you agree with that? Which is, if true, that is just, you know, I'm not too sure what words to describe, because we're looking at a country that has been a victim for decades now, and it's just beyond words. And we here in Iran obviously see that, not only because of the close proximity that we have in terms of a neighbor, but also because of the influx of refugees that come into Iran, escaping what has happened there for the past decades. But do you think that is a train of thought that the U.S. perhaps has? And as our guest there mentioned, perhaps the arms manufacturers smiling at the fact that you have an Afghanistan that's in tatters.
Not only arms manufacturers, but, you know, the great geopolitical strategist whose idea was, you know, foment jihadi groups in the Caucasus, in the south of the old Soviet Union. Now foment jihadi groups right next to Iran. You know, they know what's going to happen. They're not that stupid. They look that stupid, but there are people involved in this who know what's going, the inevitable results of this. They're going to create more enemies. You're going to drive people into the hands of ISIS, which is already in Afghanistan, has a presence, and other groups like that have a presence in Afghanistan. From their point of view, not only is it the permanent war, you know, as Orwell and Julian Assange said, the point of the war isn't to end the war. The point of the war is to keep it going forever as this constant stream of profits to the arms manufacturers. But it's also a constant stream of now tension and aggravation and diversion for the countries around Afghanistan that now have to deal with those problems. And that's Iran, it's Russia, et cetera. So they want that tension there, and they want the arms, and they want the chaos, really. This is what the United States has been doing for the last 20 years, is, you know, fomenting chaos.
Well, taking a look at the act itself, Brian Terrell, it's basically, I was curious as to see the figure $10 billion also thrown in as to the real figure here held by the central bank, which is said to, once this is held, then the banks within Afghanistan, where they're starving for cash, and it's going to cause Afghan businesses and then to suffer because they don't have the money to then pay out, for example, to the citizens or to business, for example, owners. And, of course, then the access to this money is going to be withheld. And, therefore, you have an economy which, as shattered as it was, is going to just basically have the wind knocked out of it. So, you know, this chain of events, is there's no way escaping it. Puts into question the U.S. announcement by Joe Biden that we don't want the Taliban to have access to this money. But it sounds like there's a revenge taking place against the nation of Afghanistan and its people.
Yes, these sanctions are not hurting the Taliban. In fact, they are making the Taliban stronger by as we mentioned, the demonstrations in Kabul and the hatred toward the United States for this outrageous act. I've also had the opportunity to visit Iraq in 1998 during the sanctions there, and visited the hospitals and the schools, and the sanctions against that country were not hurting the upper crust, the cadres that were running the country. It was hurting the common people. This is something that charity is all very fine, and I think for people who are hungry, if some people do end up getting some food out of this. $3 billion that they're getting. I hope it saves some lives. But what's demanded is justice. I mean, this is not an act of charity for someone to steal someone's food and then give them a few crumbs. It's not our money. And if the Taliban is not to be trusted. The United States trusted a very, very corrupt government, a narco republic, it's been called, that it put in place and supported with tons of cash for 20 years. Taliban is not going to be any worse. It isn't our money we shouldn't even be thinking about it. It shouldn't be something that U.S. has any say whatsoever. It's a crime.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, I'm wondering how the Taliban is going to position itself when it comes to the U.S. You have the spokesman for the Taliban condemning the U.S. for stealing the property of Afghan people. As he stated, posting on social media that the theft of the frozen assets shows the U.S. has degraded to the lowest level in human nature. What kind of reactions will we see from the Taliban? I'm guessing, first of all, that the Afghans are going to really rally perhaps behind the Taliban, because in essence they're seeing this face of the U.S. So that's one of the outcomes here. But regarding the Taliban, what can we see from them?
Well, they'll certainly rally against the United States. And briefly, at least in the short run, they'll rally around the Taliban government. But the Taliban are in a difficult position, and they're economically weak, and they're going to need help. I think what you're going to see from the Taliban, as I suggested, is they're going to have to turn to other people who are capable and willing to help them, you know, in a non-cruel way, in a just respectful, bilateral way. So that's likely to be the neighbors, Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan, you know, and these are the places that they're going to have to look for help in terms of, the Taliban is a governing party that they have to find some help for themselves. So that's what they're likely to do. Politically on the ground, it's going to be anti-American, pro-Taliban. If the Taliban can succeed in getting help from other countries, they will definitely cement their position politically in relation to the masses in Afghanistan. So that's what we're going to see that playing out over the next few months, probably. And because it's an emergency, and somebody, they have to get something from somebody. And, there aren't 100 actors that can save them. There are, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 in the world.
Okay, unfortunately, I'm only left with about 30 seconds to give to you, Brian Terrell, as the last question here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to go after American bashing here, but I'm looking at a social media post where it says, I can't remember the last time so many people of such vastly different worldviews were so united over a U.S. policy decision on Afghanistan in this case. Do you agree?
I haven't heard that. I'm glad to hear that. I hope that there is universal disdain and protest over this. That truly can't stand. And we are, and the urgency of the situation is, the winters are very, very cold in Afghanistan, and there will be many, many deaths just in the next hours, the next days. This is a matter of utmost urgency.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. Thank you so much. Jim Kavanaugh, thank you for your contribution. Writer and blogger, The Polemicist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikava Tahwai, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. A busy bazaar, as if all the people are here. You might ask yourself why I have come to this bazaar. Indeed, I am here to buy some souvenirs for my friends. Tonight, I'm going to take a trip to Yazd to visit my friends there. Also, the day after, I have planned to visit the ancient village of Kharonagh. Kharonagh village dates back to 4,500 years ago, and is surely a spectacular place to visit. The historical village of Kharonagh is located in Yazd province, 70 kilometers to Ardekan County. In this region, there are iron ore, zinc, and granite mines. There is also a protected area in this region, which is home to animals like wild goat, sheep, mufflon, wildcat, caracal, and cheetah. Kharonagh, which used to be called Khuranagh in the past, means the place where the sun rises or the place where the sun is born. Kharonagh village has placed one of the large adobe structures of Iran in itself. This village has two parts. The new part in which over 500 people live, and the old part, or the castle of Kharonagh, which is damaged and empty. Some of the must-see landmarks of this village include Kharonagh Castle, the historical bath of Kharonagh, Kharonagh Caravan Sarai, Kharonagh Mosque and Hosseiniye, as well as the shaking minaret of Kharonagh. I am now in Kharonagh village. This village is ancient, and I'm so excited to see it. Kharonagh village dates back to the Sassanid era. This village used to be a place for taking rest by merchants and travelers. Let's look around the village together. I am now at Kharonagh Castle. This castle dates back to the Sassanid era. Well, this castle is surrounded by deep moats. These moats were used as a way to protect the residents of the castle against enemy forces. Six guard towers are attached to the body of the castle. There are 80 houses in this castle. In most villages of the Yaz city, you see nothing but adobe and mud. Oh, I'm so thirsty. My flask has run out of water. What a scent! The smell of wet earth is very pleasant. I'm crazy about this scent. Kharonak village, like the city of Isfahan, has a structure called Shaking Minaret or Minar Jumban, which shakes. This minaret also dates back to the Sasanid era. Its height is 15 meters. The Shaking Minaret of Kharonak used to have three floors. Its top floor used for watching and lighting. It used to have a wooden structure on its top, which had been tilted because of earthquakes and wind blow. So the locals of Kharonak had detached it and brought it down. To be honest, I don't dare to get close to it. I am now at the center of Kharonak Castle. Here, there is the Kharonak Jame Mosque. This mosque dates back to the 8th to 10th century AH. Adobe and mud are the main materials used for building this mosque. Though, as it shows, bricks are also used in the minarets and facade of the mosque. It's very beautiful and spectacular. Actually, Kharonak has many must-see places to visit, and unfortunately, I can't describe them all for you. Just tell you one thing. Don't miss the night sky of this region if you happen to visit here. The stars in this region are so near to you that you feel you can touch them all with your hands. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.